Hello, welcome to this week's Football Fans Podcast, The Shootout, the second in our brand new editions of our sister podcast, The Shootouts. This week on the pod, I'm joined by the former Wimbledon, Watford and Jamaican international, Marcus Gell. Marcus, what are you saying, man?
Good morning.
You good?
Jordan, yeah, I'm fresh, I'm awake. The snow didn't hold me back from getting into town.
I appreciate you coming in. It's a Sunday morning and it has been snowing in some parts of the south and it's early. So I appreciate you coming in.
My pleasure.
To come on the pod, man. Marcus, so let's talk. I'm going to talk about a lot of things with you this morning here. But let me start and bring you back now to Brentford days.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how you initially were scouted and how you initially began playing for that particular club.
I was playing Sunday league football, so it might surprise people that I didn't just start off in the professional game. I was just playing school football, county football. Got into Sunday league football at about 12 years of age. Had a year or two playing for a team out in Hayes. And that's where I got scouted at 13, 14 by Brentford. So for me, getting into a professional club, it was 14, not 6, not 7, 14. So I had a childhood before I even got into the game.
Yeah.
So I had a good balance of life, some fun, but also my ambition was to make it as a professional. And that was more as my dream, even before, I got into the club at 14. So I played in the schoolboys, played in all the age groups, and then left school at 16. And I'll tell you this as well. We say this on our talks with Troy and the work that we do with Kick It Out, is that I left school donkey blinkered. I'd done my exams. I don't even know how well I'd done in my exams, even to this day. And I preach to the players that, you know, education has to run alongside your sporting achievements or your ambitions. But that didn't hold me back. I knew I didn't have too much choices because of the lack of knowledge for my exams. So everything was channeled and just donkey blinkered into, I'm making this no matter what. Because I loved the game. It wasn't about money. It was just like, this is all I wanted to do. So nothing was going to stop me. No partying, no girls and all this sort of stuff. Football was my party. Football was my girl.
Yeah.
And that's how I stayed on it. And I progressed through the ranks again, through the youth team. We had a very good youth team at League One, you know. A team like Brentford had a semi FA Youth Cup semi-final team, which is kind of unheard of. A small club, but we got to the FA Youth Cup semi-final.
I want to come back to the youth team at Brentford in just a second, but I just want to go slightly back to something you mentioned. You said there that I had a childhood. Why do you think it was so important for you as an emerging player to have had that childhood before you made that step up into the big world of football?
I think you just experienced different things. I was going camping, was riding bike. I had friends that would go to the adventure playgrounds. I'm not sure they have them anyway now, but just had a regular upbringing, regular childhood, done just ordinary things, experienced good things. And then football, I knew it was like, well, that's the dream. You've got to go down that road. But at least I've got, you know, my younger years to look back on and think, I've done this, I've done that. I don't think the kids today, they don't experience that because they're so cocooned in the model of you got to be a footballer and as young as possible. So you got players that are going in, well, I can't say they're players yet. They're children going in at 6 and 7, and they won't have the childhood that I had up until like 14. They're already like conditioned to be a pro. The parents as well, they're conditioned to develop that young person as a pro. So the whole lifestyle is different. Whereas for me, I just had a normal lifestyle. I'd go out and ride a bike. I'd go, as I said, go to the adventure playgrounds and go and swing on some ropes and climb this and do that, fall off, get up, do it again.
And so, how does that early experience as a child and doing the things that all normal children should and do, how does that, do you think, negatively impact the players that don't have that from 6, 7, 8 because they're thrown into academies from early and they have the expectation of, right, you're going to be the next big thing. We want you to kind of just basically focus on football from your 7 years old. How does not having the childhood that you had before you were in that environment negatively affect today's footballers, do you think?
I think it stops them just being a kid. And you're forced to grow up too early. The pressures are on you a lot earlier. So I didn't have any pressure until I was probably 16.
Okay.
So, you know, I left school at that age and then I knew what the role was, what the pathway was. and that was taken extremely serious for the next 2 years to sign as a pro. So I had a gradual progression, and it wasn't started from 6 or 7 years of age where you're under pressure, you're already thinking about your adult life already. I didn't. I just had my childhood to think about, enjoy my teenage years. By the middle of it, it was getting serious at 16 onwards, and I embraced that as well as I could, and it helped shape the rest of my sort of playing career, because I did have that period of I could just be myself, I could just be a normal teenager and enjoy life.
I'm going to pick up where you left off with your career once you kind of moved on from Brentford, but just finally on Brentford, it was announced I think about a year ago they were going to be scrapping their senior youth team, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's 2 years ago now.
A couple of years back now, yeah. What are your thoughts on them doing that and their rationale? Because as far as I was, from what I read, they said they did it because the operational costs just weren't sustainable. And it's, in theory, it's lovely to have this youth academy and bring through young kids, but if it's potentially going to cripple the club, we can't sustain that.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts when you first heard that?
Initially, I was angry because I was, if it was 30 years ago, I would have been part of that process that was, you know, if you're 16, is that you know what you're looking to do and get into the full-time academy. And if I was there at 16 and that was taken away, that would have devastated me. And then you've got to pick up the pieces and find another club. And I think most of the players have found another club. Some of them have found, you know, a higher club to play at and progress their career. But you can understand where the chairman's coming from in terms of it's costing X amount and we're not producing enough. From my personal view, is it's the kids that have taken the brunt of all of this, and it's not their fault. I would personally look at, well, who's coaching? The coaches need to take responsibility, not the players, because there is talent in this country. We've seen it over the last year. There is serious talent in this country. It's down to the coaching and where that puts them next. And with Brentford, I would say the coaching weren't right, because these players, some of them have gone on. I've seen them in talks at Premier League clubs. So the talent is there. I think Huddersfield done the same thing. And about 4 or 5 of those Huddersfield players didn't end up in Championship. They stayed at Premier League level with a bigger club. So it shows that there is talent there, but I think it's down to the coaching.
Do you think football clubs are obligated to their cities, towns and communities to have youth teams, or do you think they're obligated to do what is best to financially sustain themselves? So it should be about, first of all, what is going to be beneficial for us as a club / business, or do you think clubs should all have a youth team and therefore that avenue is always opened to local talent being filtered into that particular club?
It's a bit of both, to be fair. I can see that, you know, clubs need to have a structure, they need to have a model to follow, but also the players, they need somewhere local to play as well, because they, you know, you're hearing reports of Man City spending millions in London, and we're hours away from each other, but they're spending millions on their youth academy in London, scouting, they're putting in the hard graft and picking and you know, cherry picking the best players around, because, you know, they're the top side in England at the moment. When you go back to Brentford and you look at what they've done since then, they've created a B team. So it's players between 17 and 21 that they'll look at and try and polish them up to get into the first team. And this season, they've got a young centre-back, Chris Metham. He's only played probably 20 matches, but already we've seen the fruit from him in terms of he's just been called up for the Wales senior squad because he's been given that time to develop. A clear pathway has been put before him to get into that first team, and he's taken it. This year, you know, the rest of the squad has not quite been with him at that level, but you can see the benefits of, you know, the B team doing what it's doing, polishing up talent that not necessarily came from Brentford but have come from somewhere else, give him the playing time and the experience. But this year it's worked for Brentford, but not all clubs are going to be operating like that.
No. So from boys to men, let's forward now to Wimbledon. one of the things that struck me about, or strikes me about modern day football, and it's kind of alluded to quite often, is the lack of leaders and captains you have in the modern day game. It was initially pinpointed at my football team, Arsenal, over the last 5 or 6 years. No leaders, no captains. Yeah. But I think in the last 3 or 4 years, you can extrapolate that out to the wider Premier League and even possibly Europe. How many captains, leaders and men that can drag a team across over the line, across football in general? In the team that you played in Wimbledon, it seemed to me like, and I'm going to be respectful here, there wasn't the most talented group of players, but they were professional and they were men that wanted to win and get the job done. Where do you think that's been lost in the time since you've retired to the present day in current football players?
I think the influx of money, the pressure of having a microphone flung in your face straight after a game, and you have to be ultra professional. What upsets me is that you put the microphone in front of any Premier League player, you could put it in front of 3,000. They're all the same. There's no difference from what I can see. When they give an answer, it's like it's all scripted. There's no real person behind it. And I think that's where the game's going. It's producing, like, to me, mechanical characters where someone just can't say how they feel without fear of retribution or whatever. But back in my day, it was, if you're upset after the game, you express it. You can see it on the facial expressions. You hear it with the words or whatever. But the game's changed so much. It's changed in a lot of positive ways. But for me, the character side of it has affected it, because you don't see, you know, your team, Arsenal, you don't see people pointing fingers. You don't see people like, oh, wait, you need to step this up. You can't be doing this, you can't be doing that. So the game has evolved and had people that just get on with their roles and don't show that they're upset. And I think that separates them from the fans, because the fans are constant. Fans will always tell you how they feel, whether it's good, bad or indifferent. They've always got that outlet. And I think at times they need people that can just go and talk to them and just be real with them, give them honesty instead of all this sort of political answers and all that. That, you know, it can buy you some time, but eventually you're going to run out of that time. And people want to get in your face and say, look, what the hell is going on, really?
and who are some of the characters in that Wimbledon team that did that for you? Who were in your dressing room in that Wimbledon, your Wimbledon days, who were the players that they would tell you about yourself, and they would tell you, for half time you need to, who were the kind of guys that,
There was obviously, when I first got there was John Fashanu, who was cool, calm, calculated, very dangerous as well. So
dangerous how?
He was a black belt, so that's dangerous.
That's
enough.
That's right.
You seen the shape of his elbows and his knees. You didn't want to run into those. So I learned a hell of a lot in the first month or so, just playing with him, because I didn't really train with him. He only used to turn up on a Friday, do the young v old, and then match day Saturday, wouldn't see him until the next Friday.
Okay.
But in those games I played with him, I had about 10 matches with him. I just watched his mannerism, how he intimidated mentally, and if he had to, physically, he'll demonstrate that as well. So that was a character. Obviously, Vinny as well. He was like the lieutenant, a very loud. You always knew when Vinny was coming. So when he was after someone on the pitch, I'd be laughing like, but you can't avoid that. He's telling you he's coming and you still can't avoid that. Don't let him get to you. So I learned from these guys. You had captains like Robbie Earle as well, after when Vinny left. A more professional sort of character and player, dedicated himself hard to the game, very encouraging on the field of play as well, and would take it would take leadership on the field in terms of if we were struggling or whatever and we need to get a goal. He said, I know Gaffer said come back, don't come back, stay out there, let's get the ball to you and get something for us, make something happen, a goal, a cross, whatever, assist, get us something. And he took that sort of leadership role in the team and that responsibility. But you did have quieter characters that would, you know, Chrissy Perry, Ben Thatcher, or I don't know if you can call Ben a a quiet character. He done things off the, well, he done things on and off the field,
yeah,
and you had to keep your eye on him. You had him on a short lead most of the time, until it was a game when you let him off and he's just like a runaway beagle that time. You can't get him back.
Was you ever scared at any point in that time? Was you ever in amongst those big characters, big voices, big personalities? As a young man, was you ever like, did you ever feel intimidated? It's like, boy,
it's a no.
Big, no? You were quite comfortable, confident.
From my background, I'm from Shepherd's Bush, so it's full of characters anyway, so that held me in good stead. I knew there was a respect line and all this sort of stuff. But ultimately, I knew I was technically a much better player than Vinny, much better player than Fash, technically. And I thought if I could add some of their characteristics to my game, so the mind games they played on players, where they were getting in their opposition's mind before a match or, and during a match, I took that on board, but I just added my skill to the game. And I kept that from day one, once I was with them. But there was good people to learn from, but I was never intimidated. I think myself and Vinny had an incident 20-odd years ago, and this is during a match. It kicked off between me and him when he was trying to give me some stick outside on the pitch, and I told him in no uncertain terms where to go. I thought that was it until he come charging into me at half-time, and me being me, well, I was quiet. Yeah. I'm a quiet character. My background is my dad's Jamaican, my mum's from Barbados. Most people just see the Bayesian part of me.
Okay.
That's 90% of me.
Okay.
The 10% Jamaican just on standby.
But, ready to go, but if necessary.
When this thing happened, there weren't no Bayesian in sight.
It was all 10%.
This was 100% full out Jamaican Wolverine that just went loose in this changing room, and it scared everybody to the point where I couldn't remember what happened for a couple of days. Lashed out, I put him in his spot, and that was it. I think the press got hold of it and made out like he was doing his job and I was a cheeky little sod. But what they don't know is that it only took me one punch.
Okay.
And the rest of it was done. So he had to just keep himself cool from that point on. If he wanted to open his mouth after training or through games, he really couldn't, because he's been put down by a so-called younger one in the squad.
I was going to say, how did he respond to that? Did he, in a way, almost respect you more? Did he just think, sure?
No. He had more respect, because from that moment on, because he was a bully at the club. He was a bully. Let's get no, or mix no bones about it. But from that incident, that changed the club. It changed my sort of standings in the club, where they thought, he's quiet, but don't mess. Because that's me. I was just like, I'm just quiet. But if you want to get in my face, then you know what?
We can have it.
You best come with your A game and deal with it. But the youngsters from that point could all point a finger at him and tell him, pull his finger out.
Okay.
As to before, they wouldn't do it because they was intimidated by him. Okay. So it did change the way we kind of went about things. We're still mischievous. But there was his level of confidence dropped from that point because of what happened and how it happened.
What do you think of AFC Wimbledon now, and kind of what's happened to that club since it kind of disbanded and has reemerged, and MK Dons are doing their thing? What are your thoughts on where the club are now?
They've done very well. I was part of the club for 5 years. I signed for the club in 2007, and I was looking to just play my last senior year in football, just to say thanks to the fans and all that. And we had a good time for 5 years. I think we had 3 promotions during that time. And that was my aim, was to come and get the club out of the Ryman Premier League and then retire, which we did. But I stayed on for another 4 years as development coach until that role was disbanded when we got to League Two. So I had a good development group of players, but it was hard in terms of developing players to get into a first team that's always getting promoted. So the gap was always getting bigger. So my task was always getting harder. But that didn't faze me. I was like, you know what? I've got to train you as if you're pros, even though we're in non-league.
Yeah.
But I told him from day one, I'm going to talk to you like a pro. And it's just in case we do make it.
Sure.
So when you get there ain't no surprise. Sure. There ain't no shock. You just go and do your thing. There's one or two playing now. There's Ryan Jackson down at Colchester. He was my first one to come through, and he was like awesome. He was a centre forward. Well, he appeared to me as a centre forward, but really he was a right winger. He was a bit too scared to come and talk to me. He said he's a right winger. And then I had a problem at right back in the game, and I said, Jacko, I beg you, just fill in that right back. So he's rolled his eyes, kissed his teeth. Well, just get back to it.
Just get so on with it.
He was out of position, and this recovery run, I'll never forget, he gave the guy about 10 yards and he's just gone like Usain Bolt, got back, shrugged him off the ball, pinged the ball up the line, and I thought, there's something in this kid. Mm-hmm. Put him back to right wing. Then a couple matches later, I said, I'm going to talk to him before the match and say, look, I think I need you to go right back. And he said, you know what, Gailey? I think I like it right back.
Okay.
So I said, all right, Rude Boy, let's work on this and let's push it. So we did that for the remainder of that season. And by the end of that season, I think he played about 11 matches in the first team at right back.
Okay.
And that's where he plays now. Not right wing, not centre forward. Which he's made his career as a right back. And that was because the two of us combined to see that the understanding of him, your characteristics suits this position because he's a specimen, he's quick. But, you know, disappointing that the group was disbanded in 2012. So we're League Two now. And there was no pathway for me as a coach.
Mm.
So I came back in the summer. Well, I didn't even come back in the summer. I just knew the role wasn't there, so I had to move on. I had to go from League Two into non-league and take over Staines for 2.5 years, which was good for my development.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was always disappointed that, you know, the club couldn't see a pathway for me as an ex-pro, considered who was running the club in terms of management and coaching. Mm-hmm. There was no professionals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the manager was, he's a non-league legend in my view. He's got a good eye for non-league players. That's Terry Brown, but we got onto a point until we clashed and I had to put him in his place and tell him, you don't ever talk to me like that. You know what I mean? So from then it was just like, you're never going to succeed here because of his personal view. So that stunted my development at the club, which is disappointing. And the club backed him and I left under a bit of a cloud as if I'm some sort of troublemaker, but I was nowhere near a troublemaker. You're going to try and disrespect me in front of everybody, prepare for a tsunami or two, because it doesn't work like that with me. You know, when I look at the pathway of my progression, the assistant manager was part-time and we're in full-time football. So the assistant manager, he was a bailiff.
Mm.
So he would only do 2 days and then be working 2 days elsewhere.
Mm.
And then the coach is a taxi driver and still is, and he would do 2 days and not do 2 days.
Mm.
And this is League Two football.
Okay.
So when I'm looking at that and I'm like, the manager ain't got the sense to like say, Gailey, you've got enough people there to look after your group. Come up and help me coach the first team or whatever. Because the first team players would always come to me for advice, how to do this. Can you do some extras with me? I said, look, that's your staff.
Yeah.
I don't want to step on anyone's toes, but I can see what they want. They got a need to come and talk to an ex-pro that's been there, seen it and done it.
Mm-hmm.
And they can relate to that instead of who they've got. And that's no disrespect to the people that had the roles.
Yeah.
But that's the response I was getting. So it didn't work out in that regard because, as I said, the personal issue and also the professional issue, there was no pathway for Marcus Gale to get into that first team and help the club achieve its dreams or be part of the dreams. I was kind of sidelined and had to move on.
I want to get to your work at Kick It Out in just a moment, but before we get to that, on management, do you still have aspirations to go back into coaching and management, and if not, why not?
I think that dream's gone. I don't see for myself the impact. I want to make an impact in this game. I don't want to do it in 5 years. I don't want it in 10 years. I want to do it now.
Mm.
I ain't got time to waste and in hope waiting for that call or the interview process.
Mm.
I don't want to waste any energy in that. So the work I'm doing now with Kick It Out and with Troy is that there's an immediate impact with these players.
Mm.
So my life is about helping players. I haven't got the time space or the brain space to go down the coaching and managing route.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my personal take on it.
Mm-hmm.
I know it seems like it's a closed club anyway. You've seen the likes of Sol Campbell, how he went about going for the Oxford job.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was talk about him at Grimsby and all that. And I think he had the right things to say and do. I just think he had the right message, the right essence, but he just lost people in it by getting distracted with other things. And now if you mention him, it's like, oh, you just mentioned him, I'm the greatest brain. But you talked to Sol Campbell. I think he was on Soccer AM about 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, he was.
And he gave a masterclass out on the AstroTurf in how he would deal with certain types of player. Mm-hmm. And you think, well, that's what he's talking about.
Yeah.
He's talking about being a politician and all that. He's talking about he's got a masterclass brain in defending about different types of centre forwards. Mm-hmm. And he showed everybody for like 2 minutes. I was like, that's what the game needs.
We had on the Rooney Rule, I had Carlton Palmer on the last and first one we've done of these shootouts. He said that he was confident if he returned back to the UK, he's confident he would get a job in football management.
Yeah.
He's also not an advocate of the Rooney Rule.
Mm.
Do you, like a lot of black men working in football, share the view that it is near enough impossible for black men to get managerial jobs? And are you a fan of the Rooney Rule?
I'm not quite a fan of it, but I know it's essential. We've got the Rooney Rule, or we're looking to get the Rooney Rule, because the system ain't worked.
Mm.
It hasn't shown balance. And I think that's why the Rooney Rule is necessary, to force balance, because at the moment it's total unbalance.
Mm-hmm.
It's a boys' club, basically. It's who you know, who you can get in front of, and you're trusted. Now, I don't see the difference between us as black players. We're trusted out on the field.
Mm.
We're used for our athletic ability, our goal scoring, our defending, our creative part of our games. There's no doubt. It's like we're a commodity in that regard. We can captain the top clubs in the world, top clubs in this country. We can do all this sort of stuff. But as soon as you finish, well, tell me where you've seen a black player that is 34, 35, and he's already got a job lined up, as in coaching. I don't see that, but I see, you know, our white counterparts have all this already. Mm-hmm. Per Mertesacker already.
Mm.
He sat on the bench all year, but he knows he's got a job lined up. I'm like, how come that weren't for Sol Campbell? How come it weren't for Patrick Vieira? Where's Thierry Henry? These guys are World Cup winners as well, isn't it? So what's the difference? Gary Neville, straight away, big job, bang. It's connections. That's what is not helping us. But at the same time, we've got to understand the process of how to interview, how to go about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it was 2 years ago with Dwight York with Villa.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, he sent his application by a text. And like in the business world, you can't do things like that.
Mm.
If you're going to state your claim, state it properly.
Mm-hmm.
Find out the procedures, how to document your claim and be taken seriously, and then at least have something to back up to say, you know what, I've managed, even if it is the under nines, I can say I've got that behind me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem to work for us as black men in the game, where, you know, it's not the same playing field for us. Mm-hmm. Off the field, it's a different plane. On the field, it's the same, but off of it, it's showing us a different side.
Just you talking there is making me remember about when the whole Oscar So White thing kind of came about 2 years ago now. And my big thing was is that at the time, a lot of the black Hollywood's top black actors and actresses were boycotting Oscars. I think it was 2 years ago now, because they didn't feel they'd been represented and acknowledged and celebrated in the way that they thought they should have been. My thing at the time was, I was like, some of the biggest Hollywood figures are black. I was suggesting, it's just an idea that came from my head, which is my brain, which is not very big. Why don't the likes of Denzel Washington, Will Smith, Wesley Snipes, Morgan Freeman, some of the biggest players in Hollywood, Spike Lee, come together to almost build their own Hollywood? If Hollywood won't embrace them, do your own thing. Have your own studios. Make your own films. And I think there's potentially some movements happening that off the back of the Black Panther film, where that wasn't black owned, but there seems to be some kind of movement where blacks are kind of galvanized together to do their own thing. Why don't football do the same thing? And this is just an idea that's coming to my head. Why don't some of the richest men in football who are black, and it might mean the current generation of footballers who are multi-millionaires, decide, you know what, I'm going to buy a club. Or why don't three of us link up and buy a club? And it hasn't got to be a Premier League club. It can be a League One, League Two club.
It could even be a non-league club.
Why don't we, and I know Rio Ferdinand is involved kind of with something that's happening at Dulwich Hamlet.
Yeah.
Down there, his local team from where he's from in South London. Why don't people like Rio Ferdinand? I don't know the man's finances. I don't know what he's doing. Maybe he's got other things going on. why don't these guys decide, you know what, if we can't get a bring in, we will almost start our own industry within the industry to give ourselves an opportunity.
I had the same feelings this week. I said exactly the same words. Why don't these guys just collaborate together and just build something, take over a club? Just as you said, they've got the finances to do it. Got to create our own sort of empire within the empire, and force balancing change. Now, but the minute you do that, you're going to get accused of, well, it's only black guys involved.
Yeah.
But hold up, you see it when it's like this now, but you don't see it when the shoe is on your foot. You don't just think it's the same. You go in a boardroom, it's all the same. How many black people do you see in there? Black men or women? You don't see any. There's very, very few that are in there. So we can't be accused of, you know, employing or looking to create a dynasty with people of colour when the accusers are doing the exact same thing at this moment and don't see it. It's like they've got rose-tinted glasses on and they only see what they want to see. But I think it's going to take the likes of Rio, the likes of Sol. Sol don't need money, you know. Sol does not need money in football. Sol can sit down and go and go fishing, go shooting in his tweed coat and all that stuff. Sol is cool. But what Sol wants, he just wants his experience to be passed on and help the game that he loves, we all love. And I think he's genuine with it, that he is a football man. He does want to improve the game. He does want to have his impression in the game. You know, likes of Rio. Yeah, Rio's doing great stuff, charity stuff with his foundation. And I know he's looking to buy Dulwich Hamlet. But again, it's like, we need these guys to, at times, come off BT Sport and all these sort of places, because that's their ego, you know. Trust me, that is to satisfy their ego, to still be in the front line of the Premier League. And when you look at whoever's on TV now, it's like the elite of a generation just gone. And that's all they want. They're not interested with the likes of myself and people like that. They want people that have won something. They want to say on the title credits, oh, Champions League winner. That's all they're interested in. And the players buy into that and think, oh, that's what I'm going to do. But it's going to need players to just join up and hopefully just get a club or two and start a dynasty, start an empire.
Marcus, you played in a variety of positions throughout your career, didn't you? Looking back on that, you played, was known as a centre forward, but you also played at centre back, is that correct, at times? Looking back, do you think that that ultimately harmed you or benefited you?
I think it benefited me. I started off as a left winger, even though I'm 6'2". left footed. I love crossing the ball. I love beating someone. I like the 1v1 duel. So right backs up against me, I played against all of them in my generation. Gary Neville, all them guys, Gary Kelly, Paul Parker was probably the one that gave me the most difficulty as a left winger, because he taught me some lessons that day. I couldn't beat him in the air, and he's only 5'2". But I learned a lot just by playing against him in that regard. And I think by moving around the pitch, you get more game awareness, more game, you appreciate the game even more. So when I went from centre forward at Watford to centre back, I knew the ball that I need to play, because I was on the receiving end. Now I'm a left sided centre half, so when I play a ball with my left foot, that ball stays in the pitch, and I made sure that ball gets into that front man. I used to play with centre halves that were right footed but on the left side, so you can imagine how the balls were coming into me. I weren't getting what I was serving up. I was trying to catch things from going out the pitch, because the right-footed left-sided defender couldn't play with his left foot, so the whole ball was different. So when I went there, I made sure I gave what I wanted as a centre forward at the time. So I just made my game take on that role. If I had to play today in any one of those three or four positions I played, in today's way of playing, I think I would have done all right as a left side centre half, because I was comfortable at taking the ball under pressure and playing it out. That's what I'd done at Watford all those years ago. I think I'd have been fine at left wing. I would have been fine at centre forward as well. But the thing that it does crush me a bit is because I weren't the fittest player.
Yeah.
I weren't that way inclined. But I was based on, my fitness was based on how many laps you can do. Mm. No, I ain't built for that. Mm. I'm not built like Mo Farah to run around and hardly breathe. Mm. I'm like a Usain Bolt type. Not as quick, explosive, yeah. But explosive.
Yeah.
Now, the way these players train now, they're measuring like, you know, their 30-yard meter sprints. Mm. How many of them are they doing in a game?
Mm-hmm.
And that suited my game because I was short and, oh, not short, but explosive in my movement. I wouldn't be just running around all day long, up, down, chasing this, chasing that.
Mm.
But I would have suited today's game in terms of the fitness, but I was only judged on the long distance stamina as a, for your fitness instead of like today. Yes, you do need that as a base, but a lot of it is explosive movement, and that suited me.
Marcus, is there anything looking back on your career you'd have done differently?
Yeah, I would have taken up yoga a long time ago. I've been doing it for the last 3 years. I'm like, why didn't I do this one? I turned my nose up at it.
Everyone was laughing at Ryan Giggs when he started doing it 15 years ago.
I was laughing at him doing that. Like, I just associated that. And I don't take this wrong. I thought that was like, you know, a bored housewife. Like they go to their little gym while the husband's doing all the work and all that. And they're at home just chilling out, go to the gym, do their yoga and Pilates. But now, oof. There's never a week that goes by and I don't do it. So,
really?
Yeah, that would probably be the one.
Because that would have preserved your career, you think?
What it would have done, it wouldn't have made me a better player, but what it would have done, I would have recovered better. I would have gone into games fresher. And if I'm going into games fresher, I would have been able to do my best aspects in the game more.
Okay.
So if I have to take on average, my fullback maybe say 12 times, I might have been able to do it 16, 18 times in a game and still be fresher for the next game by doing this stuff. But yeah, I appreciate it now. I feel good in my body now. When I do have my little charity matches and senior men's football, it does pay off.
It benefits you.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Jamaica. There's a young chap called Leon Bailey who's been a bit of a Bundesliga revelation.
Mm.
He's killing it out there at the moment. How big a moment is it in securing, or was it in securing his allegiance to Jamaican football? Because he could have represented other nations or England, couldn't he?
Yeah, I think England mentioned him this week. But I think it's good to retain the Jamaican heritage. And we all know that, you know, the players that can qualify for Jamaica, how good would the squad be?
Mm-hmm.
But it's the lure of, one thing is money. Obviously, the prestige of playing Premier League football, representing England. But for us, 20-odd years ago, it was like, hey, we're doing... I had no hesitation whatsoever in representing Jamaica. When I got flown out there, I said, I just want this. I goes, I need this. They don't need me, but I need this. Just to feel a sense of belonging, a sense of pride, the sense of impact it will have...
Mm-hmm.
with my family and around the world. And it has had that effect. But
So I want to talk about the World Cup that you played at.
Mm.
Before we do that, though, does it annoy you in a way that it annoys me that some players have to decide what nation to pick from? So I'm thinking in particular about Jack Grealish. When there was a couple of years ago where he was kind of deciding, he needed time to decide whether he wanted to represent Ireland or England. Does it annoy you that, and I get that he was probably thinking about, okay, I can probably get more caps with that nation, but I can probably make more money playing for that nation. So I get the logistical and the practical decisions of that. But does it annoy you that really it just should come down to how you feel? Representing your nation should be about representing the country that you love. It shouldn't, maybe I'm being naive, but it shouldn't be about, oh, where can I make more money or where can I get more caps?
But unfortunately... it's a business world as well. Mm. So players are thinking business-minded stuff. But as I said, for me, it was like the impact, the pride, sense of belonging as well, and that achievement. But now you've got players that, they got choices. I had choices.
Mm.
And I could have played for Barbados.
Mm.
I played for England under-17s with Alan Shearer. I think prior to that Jamaican call-up, I think Glenn Hoddle was in charge of the England squad.
Mm-hmm.
So there was talk like we could get in the squad.
Mm.
I think Robbie Earl was mentioning it because we had a good season or two. We're both scoring goals. He's scoring goals from midfield. I'm up front. I'm something different, a left-footed centre forward. But realistically, who have I got to compete against? Andy Cole, Robbie Fowler, Alan Shearer, Teddy Sheringham was around.
So that thought process of Roots actually playing did cross your mind? It wasn't a case of, from the get-go, you always knew you wanted to and was going to play for Jamaica?
I wanted to play the best brand of football, best standard of football, where I can play it. I had the opportunity at 17 to go and play for England. Mm. Great. That was the only opportunity in the England shirt as a young player. Didn't play in the under-21s. That's fine. But once the opportunity for Jamaica, and they came looking from 97, they saw a few of our games and they said, yeah, they want you to come over there and just... They basically tried to sell me the country where my dad's from, which was... You can't sell me that.
Yeah,
I'm already sold.
So be honest, Marcus. If England and Jamaica had come at the same time and said, we want you to play for us, where would you have gone?
It would have been tough. It would have been tough. I think it still would have been Jamaica in terms of, I would have played more games.
Mm-hmm.
What's the point of playing maybe one, maybe two games? And that's not having a lack of faith in my own ability.
Mm.
It's just like, what do you want to do with your career?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to have one cap and that's it? Or do you want to have, I don't know, 15, 16, 17, 18 caps that I got and play in the World Cup? So Jamaica, just that feeling of playing for Jamaica and hearing the national anthem,
mm-hmm.
you can't take that away.
Mm-hmm.
I felt ultimate pride singing that national anthem. And it's no disrespect to the English national anthem, but I don't really get the vibe of that.
Yeah.
Because of the historical content and all this sort of stuff. So I don't kind of attach myself to the anthem of England. But when you sing and you go through the national anthem of Jamaica and the whole crowd are singing it with you, you feel empowered beyond belief.
Mm-hmm.
So after that experience at Wimbledon, we had a few younger players like Patrick Adjiman, and he was sniffing around the 21s of England. And after my experience, I said, you know what? You might get one or two caps, but if you go play for Ghana, you'd be set for life. Mm-hmm. You'd be a king for life because you're making an impact with your own people over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, if I was you, I would go down that road.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say forget England in that case, but go down the road of your parents and supply them with a lifelong energy of pride.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because that can't ever get taken away. You get more appreciated. That's what I told him. I said, you'll be more appreciated.
Okay, that's interesting. You played at the first ever, you were part of the first ever Caribbean team at the World Cup. What do you first remember of the build-up, so the weeks and the couple of months leading up to that tournament in France? And what do you remember of the first moment that you arrived in France? So the plane lands and it's like, we're in France, the World Cup starts in 2 weeks, whatever. What was the build-up process like
for you? My build-up was, my daughter was born May the 7th of that year. So I think I had about a week with her.
Okay.
There was a friendly match up at Man City that month, which I missed because my daughter was born. And after that, I had a week with her, straight with the squad. Didn't see her for like 7 weeks.
Wow.
So that was always in my head, but it was like, I need to do this. My daughter's going to be fine. But this World Cup, it will come and go.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to make sure I'm on it to go. So the build-up was great. A lot of camaraderie, a lot of fun, a lot of music, as you know, great food, a lot of focus as well, because we Jamaica was used to playing 3-5-2.
Mm-hmm.
That was a system that was like organic to the squad. And then what cheesed people off is that as soon as we got there, the coach decided, I don't know, I'm sure he was influenced. I got a very good, strong feeling who influenced him to change it to 4-4-2. Which suited one particular person. But the squad was fully organic, playing 3-5-2 because the dynamics were there. You got Pepe Goodison, left side centre half, and his best mate on and off the field is Ricardo Gardner in that sort of position. And if Bibby got beat, you ain't beating the next one, the bodyguard, Pepe, because you ain't getting past him.
Mm-hmm.
And you had all these sort of dynamics. And then we got there and we played 4-4-2. It just seemed strange. And for me, the disappointment was, before the first game, I was in the training match 4 or 5 days before the game. And then the last day, I was out of it. Something's happened. And I couldn't believe or understand what's happened. And then you find out after, you got certain individuals talking in the coach's ear and changing things, I'm like, what? I can't believe what's going on. Mm. But that was my disappointment in the build-up, is that I was scheduled to play that first game against Croatia. And I sat on the bench. I've watched Robbie Earl score, obviously, a historic goal.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was a bittersweet moment because I knew he was one behind it.
Yeah.
He was always sitting around the coach. And I think he told the coach, yeah, I can't defend from the front. He goes, hold up. We play at Wimbledon together.
Mm.
I can't defend from the front.
Mm.
We all understand what Wimbledon was about.
Mm.
We was a band of brothers and we had to do what we had to do mm-hmm. for the team. The defending started from the front with the likes of myself and FN at times. So to hear that coming from, you know, a club teammate was disappointing because the shape of the team changed for two games.
Mm.
And it was, you know, just ironic. The game that we won, what shape did we play? 3-5-2. Who was in the side? I'm not saying it was because of me, but I started that match, played a part in both the goals, but the team was back to its organic best, and it was too late. But I was going to leave after the second game in Paris with played Argentina. I sat there, the third sub's gone on, I just took my boots off, sat there about 10 minutes after the final whistle, said, you know what, if I got my passport, I'm going home. Really? I didn't come out here for this. I just felt sort of let down. I just felt it's a waste of time. I've got my daughter that won't recognise me when I get back home. So I'm like, I just want to go home. And I said that to some of the players. And said, no, I'm sure things are going to change for the next game. I said, yeah, but we're just playing now. There's no meaning to it apart from it's the third and final game. Now the coach is just going to play anybody. You know what I mean? So I got that out of my head and thought, you know what? Got to play it. I started. Played as well as I could. Wish I'd scored and got something personal out of it. But to start a World Cup match and to win it, I can live with that. But the whole experience was a good experience on whole. The group of players that came through, Ricardo Gardner, Ricardo Fuller, he just missed out on the squad, but he still travelled to be part of it.
Okay.
And he still came and, you know, he had a great career after that anyway.
Yeah.
So it's good to see the development of, you know, Jamaican-born players progressing nicely, particularly in Britain, Premier League, in the Scottish Premier League as well. And, they've put Jamaica on the map in terms of they can produce good players.
How far are Jamaica off from making another World Cup? How long will it be, do you think, before we see them again at a World Cup?
It could be some time, but the talent pool is there. That's the thing. Now, our Brazilian coach back in the day was René Simões, and he said, there's no difference between a 15-year-old Brazilian and a 15-year-old Jamaican for talent. He said, by 16, it's the coaching from that point on. So he's already identified Jamaica's got such a talent in the island, is that the coaching has to be up to speed to get the best out of it. You know, we've seen the likes of Leon Bailey. He's doing his bits, which is great. He's putting Jamaica back on the world map in that regard. Imagine if Raheem Sterling decided to play for the country of birth and say, right, this is how we're going to do it. But it still needs that professional setup. It still needs that stardust, because we do it in athletics. We've got the stardust in that. Can't hide from that. But it just seems like with the team ethic, there's a lot more people involved on the pitch and a team off of it. And if those two can combine once again, like we did have, then on talent, Jamaica can make it, but I think it's a long way from it now.
And just finally, Marcus, you do a lot of work with Kick It Out, as you mentioned. You travel the country, you go into lots of clubs, talking to young players, educating and trying to ensure that the next generation of potential young stars not only have the physical qualities and attributes to be a success, but have the mental and the psychological mindset to kind of to be rounded men. What are the biggest obstacles and what are the biggest frustrations that you come across and that you hear when you visit these clubs and speak to these players? What's the thing that you kind of hear the most that annoys you and feel like that's the thing I've got to try and change amongst these young boys and girls thinking?
It's a topic involved with music. mm-hmm. and a particular N-word.
Okay.
That is the one for me.
Really?
If that can change, I think that's going to have a massive ripple effect, a positive ripple effect, and help the cause that we're constantly fighting. So music and football go hand in hand. It's played in every changing room. The genres of music they're playing, grime, hip-hop, blah, blah, blah. You know, you got Drake as one of the, it says on one of the magazines that he's the hottest rap artist in the Premier League. And he's from Canada that played ice hockey.
Hmm.
But he's in the industry we all love.
Hmm.
He's making music videos with 13-year-old boys playing football. Started from the bottom, now we're here. So he's got such an impact in there. But
and how is that negatively impacting
because
those young boys?
The N-word is normalised in the lyrics. So they accept it now. And it's just flung out there. Ah, it doesn't mean it's serious, but they still use it, black and white.
Mm.
And I, you know, on our talks, we say, well, if the change room doors open and the referee hears it, and something kicks off on the field of play, what's he supposed to do?
Mm.
So we've got to have an understanding of what the word means today, what it has meant in the past, how we've overcome certain barriers and all this. We don't want to unstitch all that work through the music choices we listen to in the public domain,
mm-hmm.
because it's affecting us right now.
Mm.
At the moment, we can't even say someone's being racist to us without this case being dealt with properly,
mm-hmm.
because if we don't take it serious ourselves,
mm-hmm.
how do we expect everybody else to take it serious? If the players accept it on one hand and then on the field of play they don't accept it,
mm.
we're in problems.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, and I know for Troy as well, we're trying to help eradicate using that word
mm-hmm.
within football, because it has to stop, because the effect of it is massive. Now for me, you look at different cultures, you look at like the Jewish culture, they don't allow anybody to use any negative wording amongst their own people from within or from outside of it. And as soon as you do that, whether it's in music or whatever or film, bang,
mm-hmm.
you're shut down.
Mm-hmm.
You don't eat food for a month or two or a year.
Mm-hmm.
You ain't getting the next blockbuster film, because it's taken that serious from their own culture, from within. And so now the whole world knows that, you know what, you can't even cross our line with that sort of attitude and derogatory terms and stuff. But with us in the black culture, from the outside, it's like, well, they use it. Why? They're not even taking it serious. Why should we take it serious? And that's how the world reflects us. So for me, my role, my job is, I want to help change the game from within our own culture, from where we sit, and get the respect that we should have. But first of all, we've got to respect ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to respect how the word was used. And the players, they always say, well, that was years ago. And I say, hey, you don't have to look too far in your family tree
mm.
before someone was affected by having that word used at them mm. and being treated like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to change from within, so the outside world will deal with us on a more respectable playing field.
Are Kicking Out doing any work with the FA in regards to this summer's World Cup? So is there any kind of work being done, even Kick It Out aside, but possibly with you guys, that is working with, the team has not been picked yet, obviously, but going into that country and that environment where potentially there will be, most likely there will be racial tensions, mm. and how players and staff should conduct themselves mm. and should deal with any kind of issues on or off the pitch. Has there been any kind of talk between Kick It Out and the FA?
I don't know personally, but I'd like to think there has been some sort of communication,
mm.
some advice, some pointers, because fans are going to be under pressure out there.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to watch what sort of conversations they have. They got to watch what race they are, mm-hmm. to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, once you travel abroad and you say you're from England, doesn't matter what colour skin you got, you're getting it. You're a target, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So fans will be under immense pressure. And I'm sure, I think this week you heard about the Home Office getting involved and mm-hmm. having sort of talks and practical things to do and some no-nos not to go down and do.
Mm-hmm.
So there are safety measures being dealt with, but I'm not sure if Kick It Out have had that, you know, that conversation with the FA, or if have the FA asked Kick It Out. I would like to think they should ask
mm-hmm.
and try and find out how to safeguard the players as well.
Mm-hmm.
We you know, we do what we need to do with the players. Give them that education, that knowledge of how to deal with certain situations and stuff. But it's a massive battle to face this summer, because mm-hmm. if something does happen, we're going to be reacting instead of being proactive, and that's what our work is about. We're trying to be proactive with our work with the players, so they don't just react to things. And what's disappointing is that, for me, you got players, you got people. Steven Gerrard, you think he's only been a coach a short while? He should be sitting in our sessions and getting that knowledge, because this is how the world for him as a coach is going to be. If you're taking your young team out there, you're going to have problems. And for me personally, he didn't deal with the Rian Brewster situation well. He don't want to talk about it. He don't want to talk about it because he ain't got no knowledge. He don't know how to deal with the process. All they want to do is focus on the football. And by focusing on just the football, you're giving the problem a bigger platform to carry on. Because now with Rian Brewster, nothing's done with his last case. Oh, it's your word against his. Because the procedures or the follow-ups ain't been in place. But when you got a coach that says, oh, I don't want to talk about that, I just want to focus on his football, is because there's a lack of knowledge from coaches at times. They don't want to deal with it. And I think that's a responsibility coaches need to deal with, because you're going to have players of colour that are going to be abused, and you got a duty of care to those players, because you're going to have parents ringing up saying, what the hell is going on? What did your coach say? Oh, he didn't say nothing. He just said I had a good game. Now, as a parent, is that what you want to hear? It's forget the game. It's about the person that's affected. Because now, can he go on and have a good career that we're hoping he does? Stepping onto the field of play just to be a footballer. Because at the moment, he's thinking, if I go abroad, there's a 50-50 chance I'm going to get abused.
Yeah.
And there's a good chance it won't get dealt with. And I know people hammer kick it out at times, but kick it out don't have the power to implement sanctions and fines and all that. It collects data. It presents the data to the authorities, the Premier League, the FA. It's for these people to go and stamp down and get the jobs done. But it doesn't seem to be happening at the moment.
Just to wrap up, you were a striker, many known as a striker. Who's the striker in world football that you enjoy watching the most?
It's a tough one, you know. There's some good players out there.
Who's the one person that you always check for? Who's the one person that you're like, nah, that's my guy?
I think this season, he's not even a striker, he's a forward. Salah.
Really?
Yeah, I just think... I've got the Premier League app. I'm like, I'm just checking it if I'm not in front of the TV. It's only last night I realised he scored, what was it?
He got four and an assist. Four.
I'm like, what's going on here? The man has not shown any sort of form like that. Apart from last season at Roma, but he got 30-odd goals. So for him, for me, I'd say Salah's kind of got my attention as he's showing something different, because he's playing from a wider area. He can't say he's a winger. He can't say he's a centre forward. He's just a forward that can go either side, scoring all types of goals. You know, he's got a wicked left foot. Obviously, Harry Kane, he's up there as well. I'll say Salah for now. Salah's the man.
In a word, would Salah get your vote over KDB for Player of the Year?
Yeah, I think so.
Really?
Yeah. KDB is... You just think, those two players we mentioned both had Mourinho at one stage. You just think, Mourinho, what is it? Well, we know what it is. You want to win. You don't want to develop. You just want to win. But these boys want to develop. And if you give them that chance to develop, this is how they repay you.
Yeah, you can get both.
You could have had both.
Yeah.
You could have Salah on the wing instead of Sanchez scoring 30-odd goals. You'd be laughing.
Yeah.
We can have Kevin De Bruyne instead of maybe Pogba at times. That's assisting and being the best player on the pitch. But
running games.
Yeah.
Listen, Marcus Gale, thanks for coming on the FFP Shootout, man. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Thank you, mate.